This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Welcome to another edition of Layla Weighs In here on Intelligent Medicine. I thank you for joining me every week. I thank you for joining us all week long listening to Intelligent Medicine podcasts. We're very happy for all the return subscribers and downloads that keep going up and up. If you're not already a subscriber to the Intelligent Medicine newsletter, go to drhoffman.com and sign up. Actually, you'll probably be prompted to sign up. So, and it's free. It comes out once a week, typically on a Thursday or Friday. So to add to your weekend reading, with links to all the other recent podcasts and all the other recent articles that we have, which eventually all get posted to drhoffman.com. So it's free, and you could unsubscribe at any time. For any of you who want to send me questions, topics of interest, comments, please email me to radioprogram@AOL.com. That's radioprogram@AOL.com. I was talking the last two podcasts a whole lot about glyphosate, Monsanto, the issue of herbicides and birth defects in rat studies, the possible implications for humans as a result of any toxic exposures. You know, I have to wonder about the rise in Parkinson's disease and things. I've heard case studies of people who live in rural areas, but when they're downwind of a commercial farm, they get symptoms and need to be detoxed or need to be in the hands of a really good integrative practitioner to help. So you have to wonder about the scourge of certain or the prevalence of certain conditions like Parkinson's, which is neurological, and ALS. It's curious. Today, I want to talk to you about celiac disease and the surge in what appears to be a surge in celiac disease. This comes from an article, really well-written article by Catherine Offord, and she talks about a rapid increase in the global incidence of the condition celiac disease has researchers scrambling to understand the causes of the trend and cope with the consequences. So, it's been seen, a particular gastroenterologist in 2015, Edwin Liu, set out to work on a clinical and genetic data that he'd been growing for more than 20 years. And the data pertained to celiac disease. He did all this data gathering, and which is celiac disease, as you know, little brief overview, a lifelong condition involving bouts of severe gastrointestinal distress, other symptoms triggered by the ingestion of gluten, which is found in wheat, rye, barley, oats can be contaminated with it, spelt, triticale, kamut, among some other things that could be contaminated. So in a two-decade collaboration with researchers at the Children's Hospital in Colorado in Denver, Liu's predecessors and colleagues at the University of Colorado kept track of 1,339 babies born in the city who were deemed at risk of developing the disease due to mutations in the celiac-linked genes, which are typically HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8. I've sent lots of clients of mine back to their doctors requesting a blood draw looking for these indicators when they come to me reporting symptoms, among other tests. So The researchers carried out yearly tests to see whether or not the children developed the disease, hoping to better define the risk associated with each of the genetic variants. Not far into his analysis, however, Liu found something in the data that undermined a much larger assumption in the celiac field. He says, usually when we quote numbers for celiac disease, we're quoting around 1% prevalence for the U.S. population. But using data from this cohort, along with estimated frequencies of each genotype across the Denver metro area, to extrapolate the incidence of celiac disease to the general population, Liu found that the true prevalence of celiac disease had to be much greater, more than 3% by age 15. It was a surprise, he says. These numbers are much higher than anything else quoted in the U.S. So researchers reading this published article in gastroenterology, they were similarly taken aback. If you look at the rates, it's frightening, says Joseph Murray, a celiac researcher at the Mayo Clinic. Of course, the statistic could be specific to the Denver cohort, he notes, but it does fit in with similar trends reported in both the U.S. and around the world. Now, celiac symptoms, which include abdominal pain, distension, diarrhea, flatulence, nausea, fatigue, are brought on by ingestion of gluten. I told you where the gluten is found. And unlike food allergies, which are often primarily mediated by an overreaction of adaptive immune responses, such as immunoglobulin E antibody and mast cell activation, celiac, however, engages both innate and adaptive immune pathways and produces antibodies that target not only gluten, but the body's own proteins. Hence, that's how celiac disease is defined. So the ingestion of gluten is causing the immune system to attack the body's own proteins. As a result, the disease is generally considered an autoimmune condition. So those with celiac are triggered by even tiny amounts of gluten. These immunological attacks lead to T-cell mediated atrophy of the gut wall. This is found on biopsy of the small intestine, which is still the gold standard for a celiac diagnosis. They will see the atrophy, the fallen gut villi, the microvilli that have been flattened. The atrophy of the gut wall, okay? So, and as the use of biopsy and other diagnostic methods have improved recently, celiac disease has become easier to detect. For example, you know, Dr. Hoffman's office, even my office, when I see clients, I will send my patients back to their own doctors requesting testing for IgG and IgA gliadin antibodies, endomysial antibodies, transglutaminase antibodies. These are all indicative if celiac disease may be present. However, many scientists do assert that the gold standard diagnosis is the small bowel biopsy. Okay. So when the first reports of increasing numbers of celiac cases in the U.S. came out in the early 2000s, many researchers attributed the uptick to progress in disease recognition. But closer scrutiny of the data suggested there was more going on. We weren't just better at finding celiac disease, says Murray. There was a lot more of it to go around. And get this, according to Dr. Liu, University of Colorado, around 40% of people have the genes predisposing them to celiac disease. The big question is, why do some get it and others don't? Toxic exposures, anyone? But I digress. That will be later in what I'm about to tell you. So by comparing blood samples taken from young adults in the Air Force around 1950 with matched samples from residents of a Minnesota county collected since 1995, Murray's group estimated an increase in prevalence from 0.2% to nearly 1%. That's from 1950 to 1995. So think about our growing toxic exposure. Sweden, meanwhile, experienced what is now referred to as a celiac epidemic in the late 1980s and early 1990s, with one study estimating that as many as 3% of children born at the height of the epidemic had developed celiac disease. This is fascinating. Anyway, after several studies based on blood tests suggest increasing numbers of people are developing celiac disease in wheat eating areas of northern India, with a prevalence, what they found in children, of around 1%, and some researchers warning of an impending epidemic there too. And that's after looking at several studies with blood tests. So the cause of this apparently global trend remains a mystery, but not at least because while the immunopathology of celiac has been studied for decades, just what causes people to develop the ailment in the first place still remains unclear. Almost all diagnosed patients have mutations in at least one of the two genes coding for HLA-DQ, and it's either 2 or 8, a membrane receptor on antigen-presenting cells that helps the immune system distinguish self from non-self and therefore coordinate T-cell activity. But not everyone who has such risks, these genes, get celiac. Around 40% of people have the genes predisposing them to celiac disease, but the big question is why some people get it and others don't. There are lots of hypotheses about this, with many pointing the finger at a gluten-rich diet, but evidence to support these ideas remain far from conclusive. So, doctors are trying to better detect and manage this disease, celiac disease, for which the only current treatment is a gluten-free diet. In addition to the symptoms of celiac, the disease is associated with heightened risk for numerous conditions leading to autoimmune diseases such as type 1 diabetes, Hashimoto's hypothyroidism or Graves' disease, and myriad other disorders, from infertility to small bowel cancer. Overall, celiac patients have up to a twofold increased mortality risk compared to the general population. So the researchers say that the stakes are high. If this disease has gone from being a truly rare disease in some geographies to being a common disease affecting 2 to 3% of children, that's no longer a small disorder. Now, the one thing, and here's what's interesting, one thing celiac researchers agree on is that the direct cause of the rise in the disease likely resides outside of our DNA. So it's not just the genetic factors, having the genes. Over decades, it's just too quick for genetic changes to occur, Liu says. We have to assume that this is based on environmental factors. There's still little in the way of concrete answers as to what these factors might be, however. I've heard every type of hypothesis that's been thrown out, says Murray, but most of them are not easily testable. Some of the more unusual candidates blamed for triggering celiac include microwaves, plasticware, diatomaceous earth, an abrasive powder applied to flour containers as an insecticide. That's diatomaceous earth. That's what's applied. It's an abrasive powder applied to flour containers as an insecticide, although scientific evidence to incriminate these supposed culprits is scant. Other factors have more reliably been tied to increased celiac risk in genetically predispose infants include delivery by cesarean section and intestinal infections by pathogens such as reovirus, although their impacts are minor. So the rule of gluten itself, the immediate trigger for the immune responses in celiac patients, and therefore researchers have long assumed a crucial player in the epidemiology of disease, has also remained frustratingly elusive. During the 2000s, for example, several observational studies pointed to a suite of dietary factors, including age of gluten introduction and influencing the development of celiac disease, but findings suffered a blow in 2014 when two randomized clinical trials failed to find any effect of the timing of gluten introduction. The studies also found no evidence for a link with the duration of breastfeeding, you know, a factor that had previously been touted as protective against developing celiac disease. Famous gastroenterologist Alessio Fasano of Massachusetts General Hospital is co-author of one of the publications, says researchers realized then that the story is much more complex than we thought. And by the way, so far, the science believes it's the gliadin subfraction that's problematic, but there are so many other subfractions in gluten that have not been maybe studied as well. But anyway, a more recent hypothesis is that the amount of gluten consumed, if not the timing, could play a role in the triggering of celiac in children. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration notes that wheat consumption increased rapidly in the second part of the 20th century as people began to eat less meat and consume increasing amounts of readily available wheat-containing fast foods. A more controversial idea is that the composition of wheat has changed significantly during this time. If you Google Frankenwheat, you will find that ancient wheat was more acorn wheat, but our wheat now is a dwarf kind of the wheat crop. And even Dr. Mark Hyman calls it a source of supergluten. It has superstarch amylopectin A. And our later wheat crop, not the ancient wheat crop, has more of an opiate effect. The gluten, the gliadin, actually hits our morphine receptors in our brains. So this is actually fascinating. It is controversial, but the wheat crop has changed. It's not what it was 100 years ago, 200 years ago. So, some evidence that these dietary changes could be tied to the rise in celiac disease comes from a retrospective 2016 study of Swedish infants, which suggested that genetically susceptible children consuming more than 5 grams of gluten per day, the equivalent of about a slice of whole wheat bread, before 2 years of age, were up to 2 times more likely to develop celiac disease than those consuming less than that amount. So, says Murray, this result tells me that the amount of gluten matters. I think we have to go back and revisit what's been happening with gluten, how much we are eating, and is it a potential risk factor? So, the amount of gluten may matter, how much we're eating, maybe not when it was introduced. But really, my gut is telling me, more than anything, is because of the changes in the wheat crop in our country. You know, if you follow a cake recipe or a bread recipe, one here in the United States and one, say, over in Italy, you're going to find 2 different textures to your baked product. That's because our wheat has been hybridized to have more gluten. That's how it's a form of super gluten. And this may be the problem and the trigger. But I'll have more to you next week on this very, very interesting topic on the surge in celiac disease. And I thank you for joining me once again on another edition of Layla Weighs In, here on Intelligent Medicine. This is Layla Mutin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.